Welcome to the Human and Technology Podcast. This podcast is for anyone who develops, distributes, or uses technology. For all those who always have the feeling that technology overwhelms or dominates them. For everyone who wants to know how to deal with technology in everyday life. For anyone who wants to understand what technology does to us and how we can get our lives back. This podcast is for those who want to make technology sexy. All the product developers, designers, UX, UI professionals, product managers, CTOs, and CEOs. And it is for you. My name is Dr. Peter Ryska. My friends call me Dr. Peter. I am your host, and I am happy that you are here. Welcome to the very first interview episode of the Human Technology Podcast. I had the chance to talk to Sam Clark, the CEO, founder of Conjure, a design office out of London in Great Britain. We know each other since quite some time, and we had a couple of very, very nice beers together. We meet regularly at various different events, the last time at the CES Las Vegas in 2020. And he's a super interesting guy, and listen to this interview, listen to his thoughts on what design is, where he's coming from, how he started this company, and how he sees the future of the automotive industry. Sam, great to have you here on my podcast. We met a couple of times in various conferences. Last time we had a couple of beers at the New York at Las Vegas, which was in 2020. We didn't make it in 2021 for all the reasons we all know. But thanks a lot that you give me half an hour, 45 minutes of your time answering a couple of my questions. And so I'll be able to put that one onto my podcast.
Excellent. Thank you very much for having me, Peter. And it's a shame we couldn't meet in person, but great to see you again.
Okay, excellent. So with Conjure, you're running a successful design studio, automotive HMIs, cars, vehicles, motorbikes, mobility in general. Can you tell us a bit about what exactly is Conjure doing?
Sure. So we're, as you say, a digital design studio. We're based in central London. Have a team of about 25 full-time with a handful of freelancers. And in terms of the work that we're doing, we describe ourselves as an interface design and development agency. And we have begun life making mobile applications for iOS and Android. But then around 6 years ago, we found ourselves in the automotive space purely by accident. And what had been a fringe piece of work for a British supercar brand then started to move out into interfaces for more vehicles and then, as you say, bikes. And now today we're creating interfaces for, we're doing some work in the marine world. We're doing some work, so we have to work with yachts. We're doing work with what I call heavy industrial systems for water pump manufacturer, Grundfos, for instance. We're still doing automotive, working on a truck at the moment. That's how I describe ourselves, an interface agency. And wherever there's an interface, we want to be there doing the UX, UI, motion and the development.
Okay, cool. We all have NDAs, and not all of our clients are super happy if we talk about them, but are there a few names you're allowed to talk to?
Yeah, there's a couple I can probably name drop. So we've had a long-term relationship with Triumph Motorcycles, and we're proud to have produced their first all-digital screen 6 years ago now. Time flies. We've done a bit of work with not so much on the HMI side, but we've worked with Bentley on 3D visualization. We have worked with Royal Enfield. We've worked with Ford Performance. We produce the HMI design development for the Le Mans Mini Ford GT, which is an exciting program. And then, as I mentioned, a UK-based supercar brand and a handful of other brands across the world in the East as well.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I find it totally unique that you work on with these motorbike companies like Royal Enfield and Triumph. I mean, first of all, I'm a passionate rider, so yeah. I owned, I don't know, at least half a dozen motorbikes in the past 20 years. The one I'm having at the moment is a Harley Davidson Road King.
Oh, wow.
And about 12 years ago, I worked on the very first Harley Davidson touchscreen HMI.
Nice.
Which I found super crazy. I mean, if you're used to all the car stuff and then the safe car environment, and suddenly you have to turn around your mindset into bicycle worlds, that is a totally unique thing. Yeah.
It was. And the first HMI, the Triumph Gen 1, it was for the Triumph Street Triple. And it was a full color screen. We had quite a lot of control from a UX standpoint. So we had buttons on the switch cube, which you'll know being a rider is under your kind of Triumph under your left hand, had a directional pad too. And so we're having to build the UX where there was very little like that, if anything, on the market. So it was quite exciting. Often when you're creating HMIs for machinery or cars or whatever, a lot of the challenges are kind of already solved. So everyone knows how media play is going to work, or everyone knows how HVAC is going to handle. But this was quite new. So we actually built prototypes using the 3D tool Unity, and we had them running on NVIDIA tablets, and we used PlayStation controllers plugged into the tablets to recreate the movement. So when testing the UX with riders and some of the team, we were able to run it that way. We were even able to plug in a Bluetooth dongle into the bike, communicate with the tablet, and then use the bike switch cube and pull the data off the bike onto the tablet. So it was quite an authentic testing experience, which we had to go through because it was all also new.
Yeah, that's cool. That was for maintenance of the bike, or why did you use the Bluetooth dongle?
It was so that we could, once we had the HMI working on the tablet, you could literally duct tape the tablet to the bike, turn it on, create the connection, and that way you were able to sit on the bike as you would a normal rider, and then use the switch cube and then control everything on that tablet. And we were able to do that over Bluetooth.
Okay, cool. All right, how did you get to the point where you are today? Tell us about your background, your career. How did you become the person you are today?
It's a broad question. Well, 1984, I came kicking and screaming into the world. my background is design. So I was a digital designer, and I'd wanted to go into computer graphics from an early age. I had an Amiga 500, remember one of them, and a copy of Deluxe Paint 3, I think it was. So I was into graphics quite early on, and I studied multimedia at university, and I had plans to go into special effects, kind of self-taught myself 3D Studio Max when I was a student. But the industry looked pretty rough, so I ended up as a web designer, and I did 3 years in two different agencies, and then when the recession hit 2009, I'd already started doing a little bit of mobile at that point. The iPhone was out, but there was no app store at that point, but I was doing software for the Nokia N95, and then when the recession hit and the agency I was working at collapsed, I took the leap and moved to London and founded Conjure. Mm-hmm. I think one of the advantages I had when I was fresh out of uni and I was a student was I wasn't the best designer, but I was very, very fast. And the sales team at especially the last agency I worked at, they would sneak up to the design studio and they knew that I was quick. And so they would ask me to create like home pages and content pages for their pitches when they were going out to pitch. And they weren't allowed to do that because, of course, I was meant to be on build work. But I would do it anyway, and often after hours. And then after doing that for a few months, they started taking me along to the pitches as well. So even though I was quite young, I got exposure to the selling process of that digital website back then. And so that stood me in kind of really good stead when I founded Conjure, gave me a chance to, deploy that what I'd learned during that period to help grow the business.
Okay, so Conjure is your own business, or is that somebody else's business that you're running?
It's my own business. Well, I say it's my own business. I own own half of it, and I've got two other shareholders who own the rest. And so yes, it was founded by me. It's called Conjure because I do card tricks. I'm an amateur magician, and I just thought it was a nice name, so that's where it comes from.
Okay. So why did you start your own business? I mean, with a talent like you are, you could work at any of these big design agencies. So what was your motivation of doing all that?
Flash will get you everywhere. No, it's something I always wanted to do. I liked I wanted to start a business, and I got a bit lucky with my timing. I mean, obviously the recession was pants for everybody, but mobile as we know it was really just starting. It was right at the beginning, and so if I'd have left the agency I was at, which was a really successful agency, you know, we'd been doing work for the Beatles, J.K. Rowling, Lewis Hamilton, Disney, and you know, I would have just left and had to try and recreate the agency I was working at, which, you know, wouldn't have been that much fun. But because mobile was so new, I got to do something fresh, and that was exciting. And I was keen to grow, build something on my own, grow it, work with great people, and you know, see the Conjure name on the work to go at the door. So it had been an ambition of mine for a long time, and the timing, I just got lucky with apps when they came along when they did.
Okay. Tell us again a little more about yourself. What were your biggest wins and your biggest defeats? I mean, you're running an own business, and there's always a point when you cannot sleep at night, where you do not know how to pay your rent and how to pay your people and whatever. What are the ups and downs that you experienced in the past years?
There's been a lot. I think one of the mistakes we made quite early on is we grew quite rapidly, and we didn't really, this is going back 8 years ago now, and we didn't really know what we were doing. That's the honest answer. But mobile was so new and so few people did it, that I think we were able to pick up work where, you know, in this day and age, like, you know, in this period, we probably wouldn't have been able to. And so we got quite big, and we overextended ourselves. I think we ended up with quite a large development team spread over two offices, but there wasn't, not through their fault, but there wasn't quite enough senior experience in there. And then there was almost no middle management. And then there was just myself and the two other directors. And that was a really dangerous period. We were running on fumes a lot. Touch wood, we have never not paid anyone at Conjure. But yeah, there was some real hairy moments there. And we took a decision, must have been about 4 years ago now, maybe even five, to basically cut the business in half and start again. And that was a really, really nerve-wracking period. So we closed the office that was based in another town outside of London. We let go of some of the clients that we had, and then we got outside help to help us properly professionalize what we were doing. And we've been on that transformation curve since, and the business is healthy. But it was, yeah, that those early days with the large teams, massive wage bills, and not the talent or leadership in place was hairy. We came close to collapsing a couple of times during that period. Mm-hmm. And in terms of successes, we've had breakthrough projects and accounts over the piece. We said we can't talk about a lot of the clients we have because of NDAs, but the Ford one I can. Getting involved in the Ford GT program was an amazing piece of work. We were a UK operation, and you know, this was an all American product. It was being built in secret, so there was only a handful of people within inside the Ford organization that knew it's being built. It was being designed under this little basement in the Roush factory outside of Detroit, and I flew out there for the first time, and it took a while to win the trust of the tier one that got us on board. But once we were in there, we were underground, like working in the buck, you know, trying to push the limit of what we could with the software stack that we had, and that was amazing to have that trust from such a huge organization. We worked on that program for about 18 months, and then there was we couldn't tell anyone; it was all a big secret. And then the big launch, the reveal, and that opened a lot of doors for us. You know, finally we were able to break cover, and you know yourself, Peter, how difficult it is to promote work, you know, when you're in, particularly in the automotive area. So to be able to take that to market and say, "This is us," you know, every other agency in the UK probably pick up and, you know, notice of us at that point. And that was a real proud moment, that was.
Yeah. I mean, tell us a little more about the Ford GT. I mean, I know the car, not everybody of my listeners will know it.
Sure. So the Americans aren't particularly well known for putting out supercars. They have, you know, you've had some Corvettes and Dodge Vipers and the like in the past, but if when you think supercar, you tend to think of European manufacturers, like, you know, some of the Brits and the Italians and French, Bugatti and the like. So Ford wanted to make They wanted to make a new American supercar. They wanted to put the flag in the sand. I believe, I'm going to get, someone will correct me wrong, it was the 50th anniversary of their Le Mans win with the original GT or something like that, 30th, 40th, 50th. And so the team, their side, had been given the brief to create an all new Ford GT, an all American supercar, which would compete and win its category at Le Mans. And they didn't have long to do it either. So they had to produce a road version, and they had, I think again, someone will correct me if I've got this wrong, but I think to enter Le Mans, you have to have a road version of that car in some shape or form. And so that's where the car came from. And it's, it's an old combustion vehicle. I think it's naturally aspirated. I don't think it has a turbo. The Le Mans one did, I think. But yeah, that's the background of the car. It's where it came from.
Yeah. I mean, I totally love it because it's such an icon of car design. And so even the colors are fixed. I mean, you have this light blue and orange on the outside. And
Golf livery, yeah.
So what kind of challenge was it to design an HMI for this car, the user experience design?
It was very challenging. The software stack had kind of was already in place, and the tools, the IDE and everything else was already there. And so when we were brought onto the project, we didn't have much kind of input into any of that. It had already been fixed, and that was understandable. You know, you see that less known this day and age, but there's more planning up front, and experts like yourself are brought in order to make sure that all goes smoothly. So we kind of had to hit the ground running with a tool chain that was already there. We also had a lot of performance issues in terms with the actual power of the chipset that had been selected. And so we, when working with the Ford performance team, we went in with these quite out there, concepts. We were given, again, credit to the Ford team. They gave us a very open brief and said, just have some fun, show us some awesome shit, basically. And we were like, yeah, we can do that. And then, but then when reality kind of came crashing home, we were like, okay, we were not going to be able to do half the stuff that we think that we wanted to do. And so that's when our engineers started working with the tier one supplier. We worked very closely together, but there was intense sessions trying to reduce things like boot time. We were getting, I think, 20, 30 second boot time on the system. I mean, you could get the car up to license losing speed and then back to zero before the system would even turn on. So we were like, we're going to have to optimize the hell out of this. And then obviously memory as well. It's deciding what you're going to put on the CPU, what you're going to put into memory, what loads at what ignition state. And so there was we had to kind of very quickly adapt to a tight feedback iteration cycle for testing. But again, Ford and our tier one supplier were really, really good. And we were able to get on top of that. But again, there were some hairy moments where we were like, are we ever going to get this thing optimized and started in the time that we need. But yeah, the team pulled through.
Yeah. I mean, this is the crazy thing. The more horsepower you have under the hood, the less you have in the electronics.
It's mental, isn't it? Yeah. When I talk to people outside of the automotive world, they often find that quite surprising. It's almost the more you pay, kind of the less you kind of get, particularly in the luxury and the supercar side of things. And yeah, it's a little known secret that. I mean, when you look at the Audi systems and the Mercedes systems, they're BMW, they're really, really good, and they've got the horsepower to invest in those platforms because they're going to be selling X number of cars. If you're only selling a handful of one supercar, you're not going to spend all that R&D and that money. And so yeah, it's, when I'm in a party, it's always like dropping that little factoid.
Yeah. Very often these small series cars need to use what's left over from the large series. This is my experience. So yeah, we have to use the Volkswagen system of the last generation. That's what they told me at a British car maker.
Yeah.
And that's super crazy. I mean, you buy a car that costs you 200,000 euros, 250,000 euros, and the car is worse than a system in a 25,000 euros car, right?
Crazy, yeah. And I think though it will change. There'll be a plateau. We've seen that in the desktop world of computing. Desktop machines now, they don't need to be any more power, unless you're doing heavy duty 3D graphics. Your average laptop is fine for your mom and your grandma and for everyone now. And I think there is a plateau there. And I don't know when it will be, but maybe 5-10 years time, once technology becomes more homogenized, I think it won't be a problem. You know, I mean, smartphones are already there. You know, smartphones really can't get much better. Now, you know, they just put more cameras and more tech on them. But in terms of what it does and its pace and speed, you know, what's an extra, 100 megahertz going to do? Nothing. You know? So I think it will be a bit better.
I call this the edge of value. I mean, in smartphones, we have reached that. I mean, having a few more pixels on the display or a little more resolution of the camera or a processor that is 0.5 seconds faster in a minute. I mean, does this really count? Does this really add value? But what I see in the car industry, we're a little away from that.
It's what is interesting is the is looking at how the car industry has evolved and matured over the last half decade. In the yachting world, we're starting to see a shift now too, and it's probably 5 years behind automotive, and so it's quite exciting having been through that, you know, and been on that journey with the OEMs on the automotive side and on the, you know, on the two wheel side as well. You know, looking at the boats, the manufacturers of these, you know, enormous luxury yachts, even smaller ones, they're starting to think, well, can we, you know, what can we do with this experience? You know, what can we change? And they're starting to ask the questions. Right up until now, they've been buying everything off the shelf and just plug it in. And then the providers of that software, they're starting to think, okay, you know, what can we do to differentiate ourselves, and how can we make, you know, make it more mobile focused or customer focused? So it's interesting seeing the evolution of another industry having gone through that. You know, like I said, the last 6-7 years of auto.
Right. So since we start talking about the future of the automotive industry, or the history and then the future of automotive industry, I think we are facing disruptive changes in the next years. You talked about the next 5 years, maybe it's 10 years. I always talk about the CASE mantra, connected, automated, shared, electric. How do you see that? I mean, what are the big mega trends in the automotive industry? What changes will we face in the next years?
It's a broad and great question. I mean, I focus more and more on a smaller and smaller part of the experience. So whether I can offer some sage insight into sweeping changes, I'm not sure. There's a couple of things less certainty ideas in my head. I think the customers, when it comes to screens and vehicles, I think you see these concept cars and, you know, they have these big, big fools, you know, full with screens and, you know, across left to right. But customers are always going to bring their own devices into vehicles. And if you're the passenger in a vehicle, you know, you're not, doesn't matter how cool all the screens are and the features and functions, you know, you're going to be looking at your phone because that's the device that's customized for you. You know, we've seen a shift away from the luxury vehicles with the screens in the back seats, because, you know, the kid's going to get in the car with his iPad or the other person on the phone. So I think a lot of these future concept vehicles, which are just full of screens, I think that we'll actually see a retreat from that. And I think Tesla have kind of already started that charge with some of the newer concepts and models. I think voice control is really exciting. And I think again, it's what we're seeing at the moment, the MBUX systems, IDs and Teslas, you know, their VPA, virtual personal assistants and voice features are still quite rudimental. And companies like Google and Nuance, you know, they've got a ways to go, but they're making such great strides with the technology that I think that experience of talking to your vehicle and, you know, classic Kit from Knight Rider, you know, the vehicle has a personality. I think that's really exciting. And we have in outside of the car world, we have, you know, VPAs in the home. So you have Alexa, you have Siri, you have Cortana, and then if you've got a VPA for your car, you know, what will your car VPA come with you into the house? You know, will it be on your phone? You know, the Nomi, the character in the Neo, I think is absolutely brilliant. And you know, this idea, it's on the app, and then it's an actual like Tamagotchi like device. I mean, that'll be a bit twee for some people, but as a concept, a vehicle with a personality or a vehicle that homes personality, I think is really exciting. And I think we'll see more innovation in that space going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you see the changes in automated driving?
Yeah.
From an HMI point of view.
Yeah. I mean, I mean people, if you aren't driving your car, you know, you're going to be, you're going to be working, playing, or sleeping. You know, these are the three things you're going to be doing. And, you know, Google and Apple want you to be doing two of those things on their platforms. And so there's been some brilliant concepts, you know, that have been pushed around. I think with Volvo, I know that the brilliant guys over at Car Design Research had created this case study where they had a car that could change its modes, you know, based on what the user needed. There was like a party setup and there was a sleeping setup and all of this. I think that's really interesting. And if the vehicle becomes a place where you're not driving it and you are experienced, you're doing something, you're experiencing something there, then all of the major tech players will want in, and they will want to own that experience. So Tencent on the entertainment side, you know, Google, you know, for everything else. And I think we'll see a war for the interior of the car, because once there's that killer experience coming from a giant tech firm, I don't think the OEMs will ever be able to push them out. Once they're in, they're gone. And so I think a lot of the OEMs, in fact, almost all of them, I think they will have an uphill struggle to try and maintain ownership of their customer, because once they lose them, that will be, they'll never get them back. So I think it's going to be exciting for us as consumers. The whole autonomy and how we use our vehicles is actually changing. But from a commercial standpoint, there will be a proper bloodbath in the background as everyone fights each other for that slice of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How about electrification? What influence from your point of view will that have on the interior HMIs?
To be honest, you're probably better placed to answer that than I am, Peter. We've not seen an awful lot of change in terms of the work we do. I mean, we've been designing HMIs for all sorts of different systems and different sectors. So, in terms of the data we're displaying and the services that we're building for our customers, it really doesn't make an awful lot of difference. You know, if you're, you know, okay, you're not going to have a tachometer, you know, or a gear number, but you are going to have range and you're going to have, you know, battery charge and there's some services, you know, around that which you add on, but it's no different to any other challenge we would take on a daily basis. And I think from a user's perspective, they just want the car to go and be cheap to run. So I don't think it will have a big impact, whether it's combustion or electric. I'm curious, what do you think? I'm really curious to see what you think about that.
Yeah.
What's your take? Did you come wrong? All right.
Yeah, I mean, from general car concepts, I believe that at the moment we are where we were 120 years ago, with when we replaced the horse carriages, the horses by combustion engines.
Right.
They basically took the carriages, yeah, and had an engine in there.
Yes.
And then over the years, the car design evolved into what it is today. And today we're doing exactly the same things. We rip off the combustion engine and we put in an electric engine, but we're still using the same design concepts. Mm. And that, for in a way, is for a good reason, because, I mean, these cars are very well developed and we have more than just the powertrain that defines what a car is. Basically, the idea that, I don't know, crash test, for example, that's the same for an electric and for a combustion engine car. It's the same for aerodynamics or ergonomics, you know. All these remain the same. And I also believe, just like you do it, for the HMI, there will be some additional information, like on the map showing you where the next open charging station is. Will I get there or not? Or do I need to turn off the seat heating or the air condition to reach it? Or, you know, information like that. So we will have a change in this. But the basic idea that there will be a separate or a totally different HMI in electric cars, that is not what I'm believing in.
I think it's gonna make it really hard for different car brands to differentiate themselves. You know, up until now, you know, a lot of advertising and brand positioning is around the handle and feel of that drive. You know, and when everything's electric, how do you deliver the personality of the vehicle for a driving experience? And that's going to be a big challenge for OEMs, you know. And how you've got the exterior, you've got how it looks, obviously, and you know the interior. If you rip the battery out, you've got a bit more space, and rip the engine out, you've got more space. But I think that will be a big challenge, and it might have to be through the additional services and that interconnectivity between house and work and car that will that OEMs will have to use to differentiate themselves. But as I touched on earlier, you know, Google, Facebook, Amazon, they're all going to be piling in to provide that. Mm-hmm. So big challenge for the automakers, I think, coming up. Tell you what, pet hate of mine. I mean, you must see this all the time. You know, I was thinking about services. This whole, you'll be able to, be in your car and you're going to get all these restaurants and you're going to be able to, it'll recommend a restaurant for you and you can book your food. I see that case study every bloody year when I'm at CES and South by Southwest or wherever. And I want to see some figures about how many people actually ordered dinner from their, from their car. it's always a case study. Everyone like, oh, it's going to be an amazing connected future. I'm like, no. It's not going to happen.
And I mean, it's not new. I can do this with my smartphone and when I'm in a car and I can grab my smartphone and then I can order my dinner and pick it up somewhere. I mean, there's one big German car maker that just released his primary car in China, and they were laughing at China because they said, hey, well, come on, guys, we're doing this every day and everywhere we are. We don't need your stupid car.
I love it, and it seems every OEM is guilty of it. One year or another, they've had a demo of that at the car shows and the tech shows. Yeah,
excellent. So, thanks a lot. We have reached the end almost. So, there's one final question I would like to ask you: is there anything else that you would like to give to my listeners as a little nugget, as a little gift? A little wisdom that you may have that you can pass on to the listeners of my podcast?
Maybe not so much a nugget of wisdom, maybe a sliver of inspiration. You know, I've been, fortunate enough to work on some amazing programs, which we touched on here. And with the help of obviously my team and everyone else getting this far. But I think if anyone wants to go on the same journey and try themselves, go out there, build an agency or just try and attack projects like that, I'd really urge you. I urge people to go for it because the little known fact about me is I don't actually have a driving license and I've never had one. Mm. So if I can work these programs and never have a license, then I think anyone can get here.
Okay. Excellent.
Awesome. Great to see you, Peter. Thanks so much for your time.
Excellent, Sam. Thanks a lot for participating. So I'm going to stop the recording now.
That's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. I hope you were able to take something with you and do something for yourself that will be forever. For an ongoing exchange, you will find me on LinkedIn and on my websites, peter-rusker.com and beyond-hmi.de. Write me an email on the podcast at beyond-hmi.de. Tune in next time, take care, and stay healthy.